Hello, everyone, and welcome to the On Iowa Politics podcast. On this week's episode, the state legislators finished their work, then adjourn sine die, and RFK Jr. visits Iowa. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Murphy, the Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. With me this week, our Gazette Deputy Bureau Chief, Tom Barton. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Aaron.
We also have Lee Des Moines Bureau Chief, Caleb McCullough. Hello, Caleb.
Good morning, Aaron.
Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times is here.
Hello, Aaron.
We have Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. Greetings, Jared.
Less than 9 months until the next session starts, Aaron.
I had that thought on my way out the door, like count the days to next year's first day just to depress someone, including myself. Gazette columnist Todd Dorman is with us as well. Hello, Todd.
Hey, and you know, now that the legislative session is ended, I noticed the birds were singing a little louder. The flowers are a little brighter. The sky is sunny.
Yeah, the sun's shining today.
Yeah, I think the state's coming to life now that they've vacated the Golden Dome.
Oh man, it's a whole new world. And that's actually a good reminder. So for the benefit of the body, to borrow from a parliamentary procedure saying here, we are recording this unusually on a Sunday late morning here. So the session adjourned in the wee hours of Saturday morning. We all took some time to get caught up on some sleep, and we're recording this week's podcast a little later than usual on Sunday. So yeah, let's start this week at the Iowa Capitol. As I said, the session shut down, two marathon sessions on Thursday and Friday, and they finished around 4:30 a.m. Saturday morning. And there were obviously, as there almost always is, some interesting legislative goings on in the final hours of the session. Tom, get us rolling this week. And let me start with one that you were covering, a bill that will change the state's statute of limitations law in order for Iowans who were sexual abuse victims years ago to be eligible for their full share of a national settlement involving the Boy Scouts. And this one was really interesting, right down to the wire. Tommy, weren't sure whether it was going to go or not. So kind of walk us through how that unfolded down the wire in the last days of the session.
Yeah, so lawmakers faced a Friday deadline. They had until the end of the day Friday to pass that law and temporarily lift the state's statute of limitations for Iowa victims to be able to have full access to the National Boy Scout bankruptcy settlement. The Senate unanimously passed the bill. Now time is distorted, and I have no idea.
Oh, gosh. Thursday and Friday are just one big lump, right, Tom? There was no Thursday and Friday.
Right, and I feel like I'm coming out of hibernation because I slept so long yesterday. But anyway, the Senate unanimously passed the bill about a week and a half ago. And there was, again, a lot of urgency to get this legislation done because of that looming Friday deadline. And it got sent over to the House, and it got held up by House Republican leadership. So there was some question as to what or if the House was going to do anything. House Speaker Pat Grassley said that he was hesitant to take up the bill, feeling that it was getting rushed through the process and it merited further scrutiny. And that even while the bill was narrowly written and narrowly tailored just to apply to this National Boy Scouts bankruptcy settlement and the victims affected by that, he was concerned about broadening Iowa's statute of limitations, again, even though the bill was narrowly written. And eventually, you know, they were able to come to a compromise, and the House rushed it through. So yeah, it got passed fairly early on Friday, and then was eventually signed into law by the governor, I don't know, late afternoon or evening. Mm-hmm. They met the deadline. The way that happened, though, is the compromise in the House was they amended the bill to essentially say that, you know, look, this is a one-time deal. This is only meant to apply to men who were molested and abused as children by scout masters or other individuals involved in the organization.
Yeah, that amendment language was very clearly designed to kind of reinforce those concerns that they had, right, Tom? Yeah.
Right. So House Republicans amended the bill to state that, you know, but for the unusual and exceptionally rare circumstances in this case, that after the fact enlargement of the statute of limitations, you know, would not be considered, and it's not the legislature's intent to create a precedent for future legislative actions. And, you know, they go on to say that such exceptions tend to erode the rule of law and respect for the doctrine of equal protection. However, a discrete group of Iowa sexual abuse victims face what they say is a grotesque miscarriage of justice without this legislative action.
Yeah. I mean, that was such a fascinating one to watch. You get up there and you're used to the normal process that bills run through. And it was really interesting the way that all unfolded down the stretch there.
Did I see right that there was only it was unanimous in the Senate and there was only one no vote in the House?
That is correct.
What was the reason for that no vote? Do you know?
No idea. Now, for the life of me, I can't even remember who the no vote was.
I believe, gosh, I shouldn't say this. Keep looking it up, Tom, while we're talking so you can fact check me if I'm wrong. I think it was Steve Holt.
Steve Holt was the lone no vote in committee, raising the same concerns that Speaker Grassley did, you know, worried about setting a precedent. And so I think I'm pretty sure he ended up voting for it in the House with the amended language saying, you know, look, we want to be clear. We feel that typically in general, this is, you know, bad policy, that these exceptions, again, tend to erode the rule of law, respect for the doctrine of equal protection. However, again, there's this discrete group that if we don't do anything, there's going to be a miscarriage of justice. We want to, again, emphasize that, you know, this isn't intended to create a precedent for future legislative action. So with that amendment, I think that he was comfortable with that and voted for it.
You're right. And I found it. And maybe, Sarah, you'll get a chance to answer this question for us. It was Mark Cisneros who was the one vote against it. Yeah, and we didn't get a chance to ask him why, so we don't know why that is. But yeah, you're right, Tom. Holt did support it on the floor, and Cisneros was the lone no vote. So
it is worth pointing out that this is not the first time that Cisneros has been a lone vote on legislation.
Yeah, the one in a 99-1 vote. Yep. He's an interesting guy. So yeah, that was a great question, Jared. Maybe we can figure that get that answer. I'd be curious to hear that if the reason is consistent with the other concerns or if he had a separate concern altogether.
Because when it's both chambers like that, that is really out there on a limb.
Yeah. And on a sensitive subject like this too, when you're talking about trying to help victims of these horrible crimes. Yeah. Interesting stuff. Caleb, another bill that popped up late in the session and was brand new late in the session deals with salaries of state legislatures and also other elected officials and legislative staff. This one I found fascinating. It ultimately, it did not pass. It passed the House, but the Senate didn't take it up. Is that right, Caleb? Did it pass
That's
the
right,
House?
Yep.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. Tell us all about it.
Yeah. So this one, it came up in the last week or so of the session, and it came up after several lawmakers who are retiring. So lawmakers who this is their last session give a speech at the end of the session, just kind of they space those out over the last couple of weeks. And several of those people mentioned in their remarks that the pay for lawmakers should be increased. And their argument was that it's hard to, you know, balance serving the legislature with a full-time job at home. These people, the legislator would have to be in Des Moines January through April. And so, you know, they need to have some sort of income outside of that that allows them to do that. Lawmakers right now are paid $25,000 a year. They also receive per diems when the session's happening and can receive retirement benefits and things like that. But the bill proposes increasing that pay to $35,000 and then increasing the salary of other elected officials like the governor, attorney general, all of those people by 10,000. So the vote on this was interesting. A lot of the person who was running the bill, Representative Joel Fry, is one of those lawmakers who's not up for re-election. And I think that kind of factored into him being chosen to run it, because if you look at the vote split on the yes, no votes. It's very kind of bipartisan all over the board, but the lawmakers who are in tight reelection races or expected to be, or are being primaried, you know, especially on the Republican side, pretty much all around voted against it. It is definitely a politically unpopular thing to raise your own pay. And then, you know, it's very easy for your opponent then to be sending out mailers that, you know, this person voted to give themselves a $10,000 raise while they didn't, you know, vote for whatever else, you know, so that is, it's definitely understandable. And so that's why kind of it's a politically tricky topic. And that's probably why the pay hasn't been increased in almost 20 years.
Yeah. And to that point, if they do come back and address this in the next General Assembly, I assume they will do something similar to what was done the last time they did raise the pay back in the early aughts, which was they passed it in one General Assembly, but stated that it wouldn't take effect until the next. And so they passed the bill in 2005, but the pay raise didn't take into effect until 2007. So they could at least say at that point that, look, we're not giving ourselves the raise, at least immediately. There's another election that will happen and the raise doesn't go into effect until after that election. I presume that if they do have that conversation again, they'll look at it in a very similar way, because that clearly tries to get out that tough political sell that exactly what you're describing there, Caleb.
Right. Yeah, that would be my guess. I mean, it's even this one, you know, people who supported it did, you know, mention that it would take place after the next general election. And so they're, you know, giving that buffer to make it seem like they're not doing it immediately. And the other thing that this bill would do that I think is designed to avoid this kind of thing in the future is it indexes their pay to essentially a cost of living adjustment. So the way it is actually would work is that their pay increases by the average of like a few different public unions and how their pay increases get negotiated. So they would just get kind of the same cost of living increase. That would prevent future legislatures from taking that politically difficult vote.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That'd be, although even I could even see that part of it. I mean, that's clearly smart, but I could even see that part of it being interesting, because exactly like you said, the argument could be, well, you built this cost of living increase into this, but why haven't we ended? And there's any number of other programs that I could think of, starting with the minimum wage, for example, or whatever else, that they could say, well, why isn't cost of living built into this? So that's why I wanted to talk about it. It's a fascinating bill in topic. And forgive me, I can't remember if you said this, but because I think there is the arguments that were made for it. And I think it's a fair argument, and why I say, and I'm not advocating one way or the other, I'm just saying I understand the argument. I can see this is that the pay has gotten to a point without being increased, and it is pretty minimal. That the argument is that with that, the only people who decide to run for office are the ones who can afford that, because they don't need the income. And so which may be fine in your mind, but what that rules out is a lot of, however you want to call it, middle class, quote unquote, working class Iowans who maybe you'd like to have that kind of perspective in the legislature, but you're not getting it because it's just too difficult and it doesn't make financial sense. You can't support yourself or your family giving up your normal salary and coming and working under that salary. So it's an interesting debate.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And another one that did not happen, but boy, this one was also right down to the very end and we didn't know. And I mean, in this case, literally to the very end, it was the last bill that we didn't know whether it was going to go or not in the literal final hour or two of the session in that early morning hours of Saturday. Todd, will bring you in here because this is of high interest in Cedar Rapids. There was discussions on whether the lawmakers would extend the moratorium on new casinos in Iowa. So 2 years ago, backstory here, they passed a two-year moratorium on new casinos. Cedar Rapids, there's a group in Cedar Rapids that wants to build a new casino there. There's concerns by all the other casinos, especially in Eastern Iowa, that would, you know, cannibalize their revenue. And some people feel that maybe we're reaching the saturation point in Iowa with gambling and casinos. So there was discussions, and we've been asking about this for weeks. And every time we were told, we're kind of talking about it, no details whatsoever. And all of a sudden, I don't know when we first heard this, Tom, supper time, roughly Friday evening, maybe a little bit after that, Then we start hearing not only are they thinking about it, but they're thinking about a 5-year extension of that moratorium that was originally just 2 years. So that was the proposal. The House did bring that up, attach it to a separate bill, and they passed it. And then the question was whether the Senate was going to take it or not. And we didn't know that until literally the last Senate caucus, and they came back out on the floor to do their final bills. It wasn't until they literally called up the sign-e-die resolution that at that point we knew, okay, apparently they're not doing the casino moratorium. So again, just really, really interesting stuff. Todd, now that that's all been absorbed, just give me your reaction to that, now it's back in the IRGC's hand as to whether this happens. Oh, sorry, Tom wants to add one more detail.
Just to jump in, for those listeners who might not know what that means, Aaron, sign-e-die means?
Thank you. Adjournment for good is the shorthand version. It means we are done for the year, for this legislative session is over. So they adjourn every day until the next day. Adjournment, sign-e-die means that is it for this session of the Iowa legislature.
And I also can't believe it's pronounced sine die.
Charlie Smith, the Secretary of the Senate, gives it the true Latin flavor, which I think is technically true. I go with the lazy Americanized sine die pronunciation, croissant instead of croissant.
Yeah, or apparently, if you're the husband of one House lawmaker, it's sin and die.
Sin and die. I might start calling it that now. Oh my gosh. All right. So anyways, Todd, casino, go.
Casino. Yes. I was a little bit surprised that they didn't pass the extension. It seemed like, you know, the legislature used to defer all decisions like that to the Racing and Gaming Commission. 2 years ago, they sort of went against that and went ahead and crossed the Rubicon, I guess, and did a legislative moratorium. So I figured, well, once they did it once, that they'll just keep extending it. Of course, this time around, you know, Cedar Rapids lobbyists and the lobbyists for the Cedar Rapids Development Group, which is the preferred casino developer here, they had lobbyists on the ground. They were, you know, working the last week or so to sort of figure out where things were and, you know, try to cut whatever they were going to do off at the pass. And so apparently they must have been successful in the Senate. I'm not sure exactly why, but yeah. So 2 years ago, they were already sort of in motion to seek a license. They had a $250 million casino plan, which would be built sort of on the west side of the downtown area, kind of by the Cedar River, right as they were, I mean, I think it was days before they were going to present to the Racing and Gaming Commission. That's when the legislature passed the moratorium. The governor signed it. So now that's back on track, I guess. Although, you know, Cedar Rapids has been turned down twice before, 2014 and 2017. They had gaming plans rejected by the Racing and Gaming Commission. We've got new members on the Racing and Gaming Commission since then. So I don't know what implications that has, but I know that they're intent on trying again, and so I guess we're going to have a good old-fashioned casino race to see what happens. But I think the lobbyists should get credit and the city should get some credit for at least doing a good job to hold that off, because that was I figured it was a slam dunk, but I was wrong, and I have been known to be wrong.
I've never heard of that happen. Jared, I want to come to you, but real quick, to that point, Todd, I was surprised by when it did get called up in the House. The vote to pass it was strong. It was 71-21. So it wasn't even particularly close. So I was like you when I saw that, especially. I was like, well, that seems to indicate some pretty clear strength. I expected the Senate to do it, but
it's a very rare setback for what I call the casino cartel. I mean, usually what they want, they get, and they want a moratorium because they don't want additional competition. Dan Keel, especially, because, you know, the market studies in the past have shown that they would get a lot of, Cedar Rapids would draw a lot of business that would otherwise go to Riverside. So
which is in
it's in Riverside. But no, it's south of Iowa City.
Washington
County.
Washington County.
So yeah, that's, and you mentioned cannibalization. That's been the big impediment to Cedar Rapids, is that they do these market studies, and it's kind of a, you know, these firms that do the market studies also work with the casinos on different types of research and stuff. So it's a very cozy little group of organizations that do market studies, and lo and behold, they find that the existing casinos would get, that they've worked with in the past, would get hurt. So
yeah, it's, well, and sorry, Todd, isn't another word for cannibalization competition, which I've been told is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Walmart is cannibalizing all sorts of stuff and nobody tries to stop it. But yeah, I mean, and the gaming people will explain, well, the Iowa doesn't have like these storefront gas station casinos, because we set up a program where we encourage people to make large investments in sort of resort style casinos with hotels and meeting space. And so in exchange for that, the state protects them from undue competition. But Cedar Rapids fell one vote short last time. They tried to get a casino, and that was kind of a downtown, smaller, urban type layout that was different than what anyone else was doing. And so this time they'll, you know, I think they're going to go for the big $250 million, you know, steakhouse, right, spa, gambling, that kind of thing. So,
Todd, Iowa doesn't have any gas station casinos, but the South Dakota part of Sioux Land certainly has more than a few casinos that are basically gas stations.
I've been to a few. When I was working in Sioux City, I was like at a few of those.
Yes.
You know, you go to a liquor store and, oh, there's a slot machine. What the hell?
I'm wondering if what kind of odds we can get on any of these casino prospects happening. Like, what do you have to lay, and what could you win off of that?
I always bet on the house, which would be the Racing and Gaming Commission, and because it's, like I say, it's a tough sell, because you are going to take business away from Waterloo and Riverside and Tama, which is not a state licensed casino, so they're less concerned about that. But the Tama folks will lobby the Gaming Commission, as they have in the past, to sort of put the kibosh on that. But yeah, it'll be interesting. Our mayor is very interested in the casino, and I don't know if she was able to talk to her Republican friends in the Senate, if that was part of the pushback.
The kind of galaxy brain thing I was thinking, and this is maybe a little different since this is more just casino specific, but I do wonder, because of stuff in the broader culture right now with gambling, like the lifetime ban of Jontay Porter in the NBA, or like the Shohei Ohtani news, if like some of those different things add up and start to make people a little more cautious about other like gambling related items.
And the sports betting
stuff
right here in Iowa, Jared, to add to that list. Yeah, and that's also why I was a little bit surprised that the Senate didn't take it up, because I had been talking to a source who is close to the Senate Republican caucus, and the impression I took away from that is that basically there's just enough Senate Republicans who are just against gambling altogether, regardless in any form, and B, may be feeling a little bit of gambling fatigue with everything that Jared just noticed there, that there would be enough support to move that if it came over. So once it did, the only other thing I will say is, I don't think it's any secret that the working relationship between the Senate and the House Republicans at the Capitol has not been perfect. That may be an early entrance for understatement of the year. And look, they get a lot of done. There's no doubt about that. But there's also plenty of times where that relationship has shown some fractures, and especially this year. And one of the common complaints we hear, and we heard it throughout this year, is when stuff comes in late, either right before funnel deadlines, or in this case, right at the literal last hours of a legislative session. This isn't any inside intel. I'm just wondering if that had something to do with it too, if some of them looked at that and said, you're handing this thing to us at 10 o'clock on Friday night as we're trying to get out of here. You know, no way. I wonder.
Yeah. It's, and you also have to wonder how smart it is to build a $250 million casino when everyone's got, you know, gambling in their pocket. You know, you can use apps to bet on sports here, and how long is it going to be till it's that expands? I mean, it's, and that's what people, you know, that's what people want. You know, they don't necessarily want to go to the smoke filled casino, which they can put all the ventilation in those things they want, and you still come out of there smelling like, you know, you went to a bar back in the 80s.
That's a plus. That's an asset.
Yeah. Now they claim they can't restrict smoking, but Illinois casinos are still doing pretty well, even though they're smoke free. But I think there is, I think we have reached a saturation point. And with the technology, you know, getting ahead of the old brick and mortar, come on in and have the buffet type casino, I think, you know, gambling is changing. And maybe Cedar Rapids gets in under the wire as the last brick and mortar casino, or maybe they miss their chance.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And I think, too, as I mentioned this, it occurs to me that that may be another thing you can add to the list of possible reasons that the Senate decided to pass on it, which is that, as a reminder here, and as Todd has elaborated, by declining to take up that bill doesn't mean you're blessing a casino. They still have to go through a very difficult process, which, as Todd noted, they've been unsuccessful in already multiple times. So that it's not like this guarantees a Cedar Rapids casino either. It, as we said, it puts the ball in the IRGC's court now, and we'll have content to cover now in the Gazette as the Cedar Rapids group goes through that process. So congratulations to Marissa Payne for that too. So.
Yeah, that was my best reaction. I'm just like, wow, we get another casino run. endless fodder.
The casino beat lives.
I have always said that I'm not addicted to gambling, but I am addicted to writing about gambling. Yeah, there you go, right? And I'm not even sure you can get help for that.
I don't think the people on the hotline are equipped to handle that one specifically. Jared and Sarah, I'm curious to get you guys' perspective on session and shutdown here. We're obviously so engrossed in this. So Sarah, I'll start with you. Was there anything, either any bills you were watching for, or just the way it all unfolded, anything that you thought was interesting or surprising? Give us your thoughts on session shutdown from the Quad Cities view.
Yeah, I suppose the one bill that I was watching for to see if the state would vote on what, or if the legislature would pass, and they ultimately did, was the open meetings violations changes and increasing the penalties for individual representatives for violating the open meetings law. And so I was kind of surprised to see that they eliminated the training portion of the law.
Remind folks who haven't been following that closely why that's in a particular interest to you.
Okay, I will try to summarize this briefly. But essentially, so this was brought by a Bettendorf Republican, Gary Moore, after hearing concerns about the city of Davenport basically putting into motion a settlement agreement with its former city administrator, paying her $1.6 million for claims of harassment she experienced from elected officials. And essentially that agreement, and there were two other employees that also had agreements with money that were not voted on in open session until they were ratified months after they were executed. So, and that is, you know, kind of an ongoing controversy in Davenport. And so this bill was brought forth in order to raise the penalties for open meetings violations, especially on individual members. And so I know we've talked about there are some exceptions in the bill. So like if a member was reasonably relying on their attorney or a ruling from a court, or if they voted against going into closed session, they would not have the penalty, but a court can levy a penalty against an individual member. And I should say Davenport's not the only one that's like experienced controversy over open meetings violations. I mean, the DeWitt School Board was found to have discussed matters in private that should have been discussed in a public session, and a judge, you know, found them that they had improperly used closed meetings to discuss public business. And recently the Register was covering a Des Moines City Council members meeting in small groups to circumvent open meetings law. So certainly I think Gary Moore, when I've talked to him, he's like, you know, we either have open meetings law and we enforce it or we don't. So that's kind of how it came up. And part of the bill too included proactive trainings that all elected officials had to undergo. And I remember in committee meetings, there was some concern from, especially for like school board members, and there's so many different bodies that would have to undergo this training that it may just be a logistical challenge to do. And so I'm not sure if that's the reason why they dropped the training portion, but
Senator Webster, I know in particular when they talked about it in the Senate, he said we had some concerns that maybe some of those requirements would be too onerous for our smaller communities.
Certainly, though, it seems like trainings would prevent some issues from occurring.
Yeah, and if I can, sorry, and I don't mean to interrupt.
No, you're good.
I'll get out of your way quickly. But I think the argument could also be made in those smaller communities. That's where it's even more critical because there's oftentimes smaller operations, right? There's fewer people, so there's fewer eyes, you know, within government on what's happening, and maybe even fewer eyes outside of government. We all know about news deserts and the struggling of community news organizations. So I could very well present a pretty strong argument that it's needed even more in those small communities. But I digress, Sarah, keep going.
Right, yeah, no, exactly. That's pretty much exactly what I was gonna say, that yeah, the training seemed, you know, on its face, it would seem like you maybe would avoid some members accruing fines, you know, if they had that training in advance and would know to discuss things in public session.
Yeah. And unintentionally too, sometimes, right? Like it's not always malicious. Yeah. It's sometimes that people just don't know that they're not doing some things the proper way. So it was either Thursday or Friday. So that was one that went right down to the deadline too. I thought for sure, Sarah, you were going to bring up nuisance adult cabarets.
Yeah, I mean that was, yeah, kind of closing a loophole in laws about cities and communities could ask a court to declare a establishment a nuisance. They already can do this for bars, but this would allow adult cabarets to be included in that.
I just love that term. That's fantastic. Adult cabarets. So we're so prim and proper here in the Iowa legislature.
Well, and are there any like cabarets that aren't adult? I mean, is that we got the junior high cabarets? Yeah, we're fine.
We don't want unintended consequences of getting the junior cabarets in trouble with this law. This only applies to adult cabarets. I'm not worried about the grade school cabarets.
Oh man.
All right, Jared, how about what was the view from Western Iowa as this circus finally folded up its tent?
Until the pipeline stuff is totally a done deal on the business side, I'm never going to discount the chance of that legislation popping back up at some point. I'm around here, it's not going away. I mentioned a little bit last week with Randy Feenster and his primary opponent Kevin Virgil going back and forth. One of the issues they were trading blows on was the pipeline. So that's not settled by any means in primary races and probably in legislative realms too, I would imagine. And, you know, we've talked plenty about it before too, that there's still plenty of opposition to it on both sides of the aisle. So I think there's enough still in the ether with that maybe for something to happen. And then let's see if there's another bottle bill.
Well, I mean, we've got the some of the organizations worried about the impact it's had, and the interesting thing is if the compositions of the legislature don't change too much with this election, the key players in this whole arena, legislatively speaking, say the next step is to eliminate it altogether, to end Iowa's deposit law. So that, you're right, that's a good one to watch in the future. It'll be interesting. Just does next year's legislature come back and say, you know what, we tried to change it, it actually got worse. Critics of that bill will say, yeah, no duh, it got worse, we told you that's exactly what it would do. And the cynics would argue we know that's what you were trying to do. I'm not saying that, so I'm not assigning motive. I'm telling you what the folks said during debate. So anyways, regardless, that's a great one, Jared. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if there's a proposal next year and what kind of support it would have to eliminate that deposit law altogether. And well, sorry, go ahead.
We'll never be fully done with it.
No, I know, right? We'll never escape it. We thought we were almost through this session, man. We almost made it. And then that group had to call a press conference and we had a bottle bill story. So close. And yeah, I agree on eminent domain. I mean, unless there's a super vast majority change in the Iowa House, that group just feels so strongly about it. They'll come back again. And I could see the argument next year of like, hey, look, we've had an election now. There's a few different Republican senators. We're going to try it again to see if the attitude has changed over there in the Senate, because that's where it has stopped every time. Maybe Tom, real quick, to put a button on this, I'm put you on the spot here. Describe as best you can for those listening what it is like to cover a session shutdown. And just how weird and unusual and taxing it is. What did we figure out, Tom? Caleb did the math. It was like 38 out of 44, 46 hours in that home stretch they were in session.
It was something around there. It was, yeah, like 36, 38 hours, somewhere around there, ballpark.
So we got 4 to 5 hour break, and then we're back and a total of 38 hours there. What's it like covering that? The starts and the stops and the long days? Describe that for us.
Exhausting.
Well put. I mean... And Caleb, obviously you were there too. Tell us, just kind of describe that experience.
What struck me the last couple of days is that it was a lot of waiting around while kind of things were being done outside of our purview and kind of behind doors, closed doors, you know. There's a lot of trying to, when you're actually in the building, you know, talking with people who have different perspectives and different kind of looks into what the negotiations are as far as getting kind of the final budgets figured out and that kind of thing. And then especially this Friday night or Saturday morning, the kind of last big actions happen really fast. So like one or two Saturday morning when the final kind of budget got submitted and the meetings happened and then it all got voted on a couple of hours later and then it kind of all wrapped up really fast. So it was interesting to kind of try to figure out how that all was happening as it was going on and then the very final product kind of moves really fast and then you got to kind of keep up.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly how I've been describing it to people. It's like these long, long stretches of absolutely nothing to do as you're waiting for the, you know, the classic deal to be made in the back smoke-filled room. And then all of a sudden they come back out and there's like three huge things happening all at once that you have to fiercely. Todd, has it always been like that at the end of a session?
Yeah, and usually something pops up at the end that kind of throws a wrench in the works.
Yep.
I mean, there were sessions where people left and they needed their votes, and so they had to go. They had to go find them. It can get pretty wild, especially if you get. I mean, hell, when I was a page in '89, they went 72 hours straight.
Oh my gosh!
It was a nightmare, and the power went out, and they made me sit in the House Clerk's office and listen to the Senate audio and write down whatever bills they were doing. Because, of course, this was before the legislative website,
right?
And stuff where you could easily figure that out. So that was, we
72 hours straight.
They adjourned at 4 something in the morning. And we collected cans all session and got Adventureland tickets. And I damn near fell asleep on the tornado. If you can imagine that. Fall asleep on a roller coaster.
Wow.
It's always, I've seen a lot of wild late stuff.
It's such a weird thing, and it's unique to anything else on the beat. There's nothing else quite like it. It's just so weird with those ebbs and flows and long days, just wild stuff. So I thought folks who, like I said, even if you follow Capitol News, you don't necessarily know what that's like. So I thought it might be interesting to illuminate that. And also just misery loves company. And we're all really tired right now. So it's nice to... Oh, man. All right. So in our last little bit of news here for the podcast outside the Golden Dome, I wanted to talk about something that happened last weekend. independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was in Iowa. And as our Caleb McCullough reported, the son of former U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy and nephew of former President John F. Kennedy, RFK Jr. has risen to political prominence in part by promoting conspiracy theories about vaccine and public health. And now he's mounting a presidential bid again as an independent comment. So Caleb, tell us a little bit. Well, first of all, did he get in any of that kind of stuff, the conspiracy theory stuff in his remarks while he's in Iowa? What all did RFK Jr. have to say while he was here?
Yeah, he stayed pretty general, but definitely hit on some of the kind of public health conspiracy theories, or at least kind of general terms. He didn't really, you know, talk about specifically vaccines or the COVID vaccine or anything like that. But he spoke about money in politics and kind of the involvement of pharmaceutical companies in paying, donating to candidates, and, you know, whether that gave them any influence over politics, and talked about increase in public health or general health conditions and certain, you know, things that are getting worse in public health in the U.S. He threw out a lot of these kind of general ideas, but one thing he did say that I didn't get the details to fully fact check, but it's certainly not true in the way that he said it, was that the U.S. is spending more. He said we're spending more money on diabetes care than our military budget. And, you know, that was just like one of a lot of things that were happening. But that just like stuck out to me because that just seems very not true on its face. And looking into it, it very much isn't to get into the numbers, but even the total public and private spending on diabetes is not as much as the U.S. military budget. So anyway, stuff like that was interesting to hear, kind of trying to figure out kind of where these things are coming from. But a lot of outside of that, he spoke a lot about being fed up with the two-party system, and that he thinks that he can be kind of a unifier between the left and the right, and that he, you know, thinks that Biden and Trump on a lot of issues, he kind of said that what they differ on is almost superficial, and that what they are united on are things that he thinks that he kind of differs from them. You know, the issues of public health that he brought up, defense spending and kind of action overseas, that kind of thing. So that's where he kind of focuses remarks on, trying to kind of be a strike out a third path from Trump and Biden.
There you go. If nothing else, I appreciate him being here, because we probably won't be a swing state in the election. So at least we can say we had one presidential candidate visit this year.
There you go.
I remember when he was here for the state fair that he was like one of the only ones that really talked about pipelines, if I'm remembering that correct. How much did that come up overall in his event that he had?
You know, I don't know if he mentioned kind of the CO2 pipeline specifically at all. He spoke kind of, you know, generally derogatorily about big corporations. And I don't know if he spoke specifically about kind of big ag, but he talked about, you know, environment and stuff like that. So it kind of broadly, but he didn't mention the pipeline issue specifically.
All right. Interesting. Did he say anything, Caleb, like, and I'll be back here in Iowa? Or was this kind of his Iowa stop? And
he's, yeah, like, so he didn't say that to the crowd specifically, but he spoke with reporters afterwards and somebody asked if he'd be in Iowa. And I think he said, you know, he would plan to be back at no specifics yet.
Has he achieved, I mean, is he on the ballot here?
That, well, not officially, but that event was an attempt at ballot access. So the way the law works is a non-party political organization can get a candidate on the ballot if they hold a convention, and they need at least 500 residents, electors, to sign a petition. And then they hold a convention, they nominate a candidate, and then they can send that paperwork to the Secretary of State. So what they did was they, and they've been doing this in several states that allow this, they kind of declared themselves the We the People Party. And then everybody who was there, who lived in Iowa, signed in, and they just held a convention right there in the hall. And so they kind of, you know, said, do we have any, they called it into order, and they said, do we have any nominations for president? And everyone yelled, RFK Jr. And so they kind of did it that way, which was interesting to see. But that still has to be reviewed by the Secretary of State to make sure it was all legal.
Now we go into bill signing season and see which of the bills that, I shouldn't say it that way, because that indicates there's some kind of, maybe not. Basically, the question now is whether Governor Reynolds will veto any of the bills. It's been very rare that she's used her veto pen during the trifecta era. So we'll see if that happens. this year. And if it does, we'll talk about it on a future episode. But that's it for this episode of On Iowa Politics. If you're not already, please subscribe to us on your streaming service of choice, or you can also find the podcast each week on your preferred Gazette or Lee newspaper website. And now that you've listened to the On Iowa Politics podcast, make sure you're also subscribed to the On Iowa Politics newsletter, where every morning in your inbox, you'll receive all the latest politics and government coverage from our team. You can subscribe to that free newsletter at the Gazette's website, thegazette.com. And of course, as always, don't forget that the work of everyone you heard here today can be found on the pages and websites of the Quad City Times, Muscatine Journal, Cedar Rapids Gazette, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, Mason City Globe Gazette, Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil, and the Sioux City Journal. For Tom Barton, Caleb McCullough, Sarah Watson, Jared McNett, Todd Dorman, and our producer, Bailey Chihan, I'm Aaron Murphy. Thanks for listening.
Can't get enough of the Gazette? Listen to the Gazette Daily News podcast for the latest Eastern Iowa headlines packed into bite-sized stories. Listen at thegazette.com or Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or through your Amazon Alexa device. Tell it to enable the Gazette Daily News skill, then say, "Alexa, what's my flash briefing?"